Costs to originate keep rising, even with more technology in the industry. The problem is the core platform. A new LOS can re-architect the process around data, not humans moving paper files. Vesta has built this LOS, and you can learn more at vesta.com. Welcome, everyone. We are coming to you live today from the Final Offer Podcast Studio at The Gathering, which wraps up today. So I'm here with Logan Motoshami, our lead analyst. Before we dive in, I want to say thank you to our podcast sponsor, Vesta, for making this episode possible. Super excited, Logan, to talk to you before we take the stage in a little bit. Biggest topic this morning, I think, is inventory.
Yes. After failing all of 2023 and not hitting the target at all in 2024, I finally hit the ball. I was batting a whopping zero. And when I talk about inventory growth, I'm taking our weekly Altos data, and I believe that inventory could grow more with higher rates. Last year, when rates got above 7.25, that's my threshold, we never got my weekly inventory growth, which is about 11,000 to 17,000. That's normal. That to me is just a normal inventory curve with higher rates. We went all the way to 8% last year, and it never happened once. So to me, I attribute that to new listings data trending at the lowest levels ever in 2023. Demand wasn't crashing anymore, so the inventory growth was very slow. This year, it wasn't happening again. Rates had been rising, but finally, when rates got above 7.25, we finally hit one time. So for me, it's, I'm a very pro-supply person, right? We need to get off of these extreme low levels of inventory and create like a buffer. So whenever rates fall, and that's what happened in the end of 2022 to 2023, rates went from 7.37 all the way down to 5.99%. Demand kept inventory from growing. It took the longest time ever recorded in history to get that inventory bottom. Not a good thing, right? But in this case, I feel much better about the 2024 housing dynamics than I did last year.
Let's talk about some context. So last year, some of those weeks, we got like 5,000 and we were excited about it.
You were excited. I wasn't.
No, but I mean, like that's how low it was. It was like, well, at least we got some growth. But, to your point, like you were looking for 11,000 to 17,000. So give us some context on what that looked like in 2009, 2011. Like what are those numbers?
Here's the thing. When we talk about the 2008 to 2012 period, I think what people forget is that active inventory, let's just take the NAR data, in 2007 was 4 million, but then we had so many loans in credit stress that they have to come on, that inventory has to come onto the states. And those are not sellers that are buyers, right? That's why distressed, when we talk about the new listings data, the distressed sales come in, they do not provide you any kind of buyer in that. So in those weeks from 2008 to 2012, we're running at 250 to 400,000 per week. Here, the last 4 years have been running between 30 to 90,000. It's basically a seasonal new listings data line. So the inventory growth just wasn't the same. And the supply and demand equilibrium was shot because of the credit markets. Here, we don't have any of that. So we need to have higher rates. Being part of Team Higher Rates, that was the thing. It's the only way that could establish some kind of inventory growth going up.
So you're saying that after like 2012, the normal growth was like 39,000?
Yeah, I mean, when we think about the seasonal peaks, 80 to 120,000 is usually what we would see here.
In a week?
No,
okay.
Yes, in a week.
Okay.
In the peak seasonal time frames. The peak seasonal time frames here were about 80 to 90K. So we're not back to where we were in the pre-decade. After 2012, the new listings data normalized out for the rest of the decade. So this is what happens. This is why we always stress that when we see stress in housing on a national basis, we'll see it in the new listings data because those are the homes that are coming to the market that don't have a contract right away. So in a stressful time, those things will go vertical. We don't have that. But for the first time, the active inventory, which is different, the active inventory grew almost 17,000. So finally, I hit something, but I just need this to keep on growing and growing. And what I don't want to see is the new listings data ever come back down to 2023 levels or any kind of regression in that matter. We want to see a functioning housing market, and we're starting our way to try to get back to normal.
So interesting. So we had 1 week of that. We're fingers crossed because this is the time when we should see that. If we don't see that now, we're not. It's not like it's going to come like in August or September.
Well,
or October.
This is the thing. The seasonal data lines is a bit tricky now. We get our seasonal bottoms a little bit later post COVID. We also get our seasonal peaks a little bit later as well. Like last year is a good example. The seasonal peak was all the way toward the end of fall. That's not normal either, but higher rates did extend the inventory curve higher. It just never got to my growth model. So somebody who doesn't have, you know, doesn't understand my model would not understand that I was not happy with the inventory growth last year, but we did see inventory grow later into the year. And that's something that's also happened in the post-COVID. Seasonal bottoms happen later and seasonal peaks happen later.
So, of course, it's very specific to local markets. So we are seeing inventory growth in some areas and then no inventory growth in others. When you look at it, I know you're looking at national data. Do you ever, you know, look at like, okay, I want to segment out this part because this is just in this one area?
So pretty much all the states in America have inventory growth. I think maybe only four or five don't have one year-over-year inventory growth. The reason I like to focus on Florida is Florida, you know, the supply and demand equilibrium works with employment, income, affordability. Florida has a very unique thing. For example, the, you know, the condos, right, the assessment of condos. You have a state that has a lot of homeowners that have fixed incomes. You get those reassessments and those insurance picking up. So it's not a benefit to them. And then also, I think anybody knows, you know, trying to get a loan in a condo project and everything in the assessments, is it feasible, makes Florida in those areas problematic. Now that's much different than majority of the states out there. But I focus on Florida because that's a variable that is not normal, and we're seeing the aftermath of higher insurance costs. Can you get insurance? The assessments, the people that are living there are fixed incomes, the elderly. So you have a whole different ballgame in there. That's why I tell people, focus on Florida to see what happens. Now, to me, it gets really tested when rates fall down, right? If rates fall down and they cannot get the demand curve that other states are getting, there's an issue there. And climate change or hurricanes and stuff like that aren't going away. Right. So do you want to, as a family, buy a house with home prices here and mortgage rates here and insurance here and reassessments on condos? And, you know, so that to me is a completely different variable than what we are all accustomed to.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, I was talking to some realtors from Florida. So we're at the gathering. We have realtors and people from real estate, people from the loan side, the mortgage side. It's been amazing. And one of the things they said was like, you know, that's not all Florida. That's actually a pretty small, you know, when you think about the condo and the association, these fees and stuff like that, it's coastal Florida and it's only parts of coastal Florida and sort of some buildings in there. So even that, like even if we started to see that inventory go up, how much do you think it would actually affect the real estate in Florida?
You know, if you want to micro take the little areas, those things doesn't really matter to the state of Florida. Those areas are going to get impacted, you know, regardless. I just think in general, inventory is growing. But in general, if you're putting the insurance variable into play, right, take the condos out of the equation, still, you know, in Florida, you're going to have higher insurance, you know, and we see that in Texas, you have higher insurance, you have higher property taxes. So to me, it's something to take an eye on. Now, the national data is still, you know, I bring these charts out of these events, and if you just take the NAR data, you know, going back to 1982, active inventory is 2 to 2.5 million. That's normal, right? We're just 1.1 million. We're so far from the bottom end range of what we've seen in the last 5 decades, but that's the national data. So you just want to kind of see pockets, and everything else is kind of You know, we're not back to 2019 levels. And for me, I would just be happy with the NAR data getting back to 1.52 to 1.93. That's been my target. I'm rooting for that. I'm going to throw a party when that happens, you know. It's been a struggle, right? And as long as the economy stays firm, rates could stay up here. It's the when the economy starts to get weaker and rates start to come down, and then we've had all these buyers sitting there waiting for lower rates. That to me is something that I'm thinking out in the future, just like the unhealthy housing market theme toward the end of 2020 and then the savagely unhealthy housing market theme. So again, it's just we don't have a functioning housing market in any kind of normal sense. So we're trying to do the best we can with the data that's in front of us, but we do see some glimmer of hope that higher rates are creating inventory and it's creating that buffer that I want.
And that is a great story. So I interviewed Ben Cohen, who is one of the top LOs in the country with guaranteed rate. And, you know, he pointed to inventory being the problem. He has tons of people. He said 10 to 15 people knocking on the door every single day wanting, you know, like, can you get us pre-qualified? Can you get, and, but, you know, where what are they going to buy? And how long is it going to take them to buy it? Is it going to be a month? Is it going to be 3 months? Is it going to be a year? Is it inventory? And he's all over, you know, he has a wide range. It's just, it's so down.
So here's where I disagree with a lot of people. I believe it's more of a mortgage rate story than inventory. Okay. And the reason I say this is probably one of the more important questions I get over the years is people ask me, how did we have so many home sales with inventory so low? Right. And again, that's that supply and demand equilibrium. A seller sells their house, buys another one. We close loans and transactions faster. It doesn't get into the inventory pool. So that explains how, you know, if you want to use our Altos data, we had 240,000 single family active listings in March of 2020. We had 2 million more home sales back then with low inventory. You go back and look at the data in 2020 and 2021, active inventory was all-time lows, and we had a lot more sales. That supply and demand equilibrium can change, but I don't believe it's inventory. I believe it's rate. I believe it's affordability. One of the reasons why I hate the mortgage rate lockdown is that it assumes this principle that someone is telling everyone, I can afford a house, I just don't want to because I don't want to give up that rate. The affordability issue doesn't really matter to me. That's not a provable fact. That's one of these things where it assumes that everyone doesn't have an affordability issue. They're just not, they afford, they could qualify. They're just holding back there, which I don't like that premise because we saw what happened. Rates went up, demand collapsed. Rates went up a lot, demand collapsed. Rates come back down. Oh my God, demand picks up. Inventory doesn't have to grow. So I don't buy the concept that we have all these qualified home buyers sitting there and saying, well, I can buy a house if I want to, but I need it, but I'm not going to do it. You know, I just don't think they qualify.
I think this is different, though. So this is one of the top producers saying he has people, and I mean, he can qualify them. They just have nothing to buy. So I think in different parts of the country, inventory is more the issue because, I mean, there's just nothing to buy.
And I disagree with that premise.
Okay, well...
I'm just talking about the general sense, right?
You're not disagreeing with his experience.
Yeah, I'm just disagreeing that we don't see that in the day. We see when rates fall, demand picks up. When we see when rates rise, demand, and it's irrelevant to the inventory data. We've had a lot more sales with a lot less inventory. Remember that. We had a lot more sales with a lot less active inventory out there, right? That supply and demand equilibrium, the affordability begets that seller that becomes a buyer. That transaction model works that way.
So, you know, we track the inventory, we track other things on the weekly tracker that will show us where things are headed. So, for instance, the percentage of price cuts, right? There's a certain number, there's like one third of all homes take a price cut before they sell. And, you know, that doesn't mean like it's a bad market. It might mean that the seller, you know, put it too high or, you know, they found out it wasn't, whatever. So one third is kind of like the equilibrium. And so you track and see, is that trending up or down? Where are we right now?
So the price cut percentages actually took a decline last week, which is extremely abnormal. So I actually don't buy that one. With the inventory growth we had, we should have had a little bit of an increase. So I'm expecting an increase to come out. And with higher rates, we should have higher price cut percentages. The velocity of the price cut data is not like what we saw in 2022, where that slope was super fast up because the inventory was super fast up. it's a much more calmer growth here. But we should see the price cut percentage start to increase as rates stay high and demand gets weaker. Purchase application data came out today, down 1% week over week and down 50% year over year. That index has gone nowhere for a very long time, just like existing home sales hasn't gone anywhere for a while.
So the other thing, you know, of course, that we always want to talk about is mortgage rates. And you just said you think mortgage rates is a more important story than inventory right now. So, and by the time this podcast comes out, we will have the all-important PCE data, which is what the Fed tracks.
Yes. So the 2% target PCE will be out this by the time this podcast. And the PPI inflation data was somewhat tame, so people aren't expecting anything. But if people aren't expecting something too hot and it comes in hot, the 10-year yield can go up. Again, for me, it's always been paper, rock, scissors, labor over inflation. The growth rate, one of the charts that I, you know, showed in this presentation, we show the 12-month PPI inflation, CPI inflation, PCE inflation. We have two handles on PCE inflation. We have two handles on PPI inflation on a 12-month basis, and rates are higher. And this is why the Fed pivot, why I don't believe in the Fed pivot. I believe the economic data and the labor market matters more. So I think that presentation was to show, look at all this progress we made with inflation on a 12-month basis, and rates are higher, right? So if the economic data needs to get weaker and the labor data needs to get softer, and then when that happens with jobless claims, which will be out as well on Thursday, then the bond market has shown us they want to push yields lower, but they just, every time they try to do this, they overdo it, and then the economic data stays firm and brings it right back up.
Where do you think the next FOMC meeting is in May, right? So we have a little bit. What do you think happens between here and there on rates? Anything?
They should be trending at an upper range until the data gets weaker. I think we've all come to the realization the Fed is not pivoting until they, in fact, they said it.
You know, they did.
Powell said, hey, listen, we follow jobless claims. It's been going lower. You know, so in that regards, I think more value on the economic and labor data than the inflation, because in theory, mortgage rates or the 10-year yield should have been lower. I wasn't a believer of that. The economic data stayed as firm until that labor market breaks. And I do these presentations now where we talk about average hourly wages. We talk about the job quits percentage. We talk about the job openings. And the labor market is softening. Right? It is softening, but it's not breaking. Breaking is something else. Breaking is claims going up. They want to break something, right? And then they feel more confident about their dual mandate.
So for right now, we're in, 725 to 750 as far as rates?
It is. And then we just follow the data. The data starts to get weaker, bond yields will go. I mean, just even a good example of this week, we had a soft manufacturing print. 10-year yield shot very right away, went lower. Very aggressive short-term move, itchy fingers. We're starting to get those itchy fingers on headlines again. So again, follow the macro data. And that was the 2022 forecast. Follow the economic data to go. If the U.S. outperforms, rates could stay up and elevated for a long time. If they doesn't outperform, bond yields could go down. And I think, one of the things that came out this week is new home sales came out. It was a beat of estimates. Just kind of remember, new home sales are trending higher since the lows in 2022 that were put in. They live in a sub 6% mortgage world, but also it's going to make it harder and harder for them to pay down rates to a degree. Not all builders are the same. Some have more money than others. Last year, we saw the softness in sales when rates got to 8%. That's something to think about because, again, all economic cycles do have residential construction workers losing their jobs. The apartment boom is a bust now. When that labor is done, those people get laid off, but the single family permits just had a slight decline. If new home sales starts to get impacted on a weakness basis. Now, totally completed units. How many homes do we have for sale for new homes? Active inventory completed is only 89,000, right? This is not the area where we get massive amount of inventory, but it's very important to the economic cycle, because if you have to start laying off construction workers for apartments and single family permits, there's your front-end jobless claims data. That's how you get to 323,000 residential constructions. There you go. But we're not there yet, but you can see it. You could kind of guide it because the apartment labor will get impacted down the line.
So what we've already seen is that apartment boom collapse, but single family has held up okay.
It's held up, but we saw a decline in permits. So the history of, you know, when I do those charts, I like to show the last five decades. And permits of single family and apartments usually go down together. This was a deviation from a historical norm. So because the builders are paying down now, apartment permits are now heading toward the Great Recession lows. So once those homes get built, we have a huge backlog of apartments and single family. Once they get built and you don't have the demand, that's the layoffs that happens in every single cycle. And also remodeling and stuff like that for residential. You see this, they start falling first, then the recession happens. And hopefully now that we're April of 2024, we don't have the job loss recession that people thought in 2022. And you could kind of connect the dots with the housing labor data.
Logan, thank you so much for being on. Can't wait to go on stage with you and Mike and Odetta. That'll be an amazing video.
Nerd fights. We're throwing our equations at each other.
I'm going to be outnumbered. The brain power on that stage is going to be amazing. Thanks for sharing this with us, and we will talk to you again in a few days.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to take a minute to rate the show and leave a comment. And make sure to tune in tomorrow for more news and insight.